The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Before we get started, a quick reminder. International Overdose Awareness Day is August 31st. Evan Pete, PhD, is an economist at the RAND Corporation and a professor at Pardee RAND Graduate School. He's one of the co-authors of an article published August 19th by the JAMA Health Forum entitled Trends in Out-of-Pocket Costs for Naloxone by Drug Brand and Payer in the U.S. 2010 to 2018. Evan, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Great to be here, Doug.
So let's start with context. What were you looking into? What questions were you hoping to answer with this research?
So this particular study is part of a broader CDC-funded project that's looking at access to naloxone and naloxone's impact on opioid overdose-related deaths. And one part of access to naloxone that has been historically understudied is the costs borne by patients, or the out-of-pocket costs. There's a reason it's been understudied. There's sort of limited data to be able to study that. But naturally, as an economist, I would assume that the cost can act as a barrier to some people accessing this life-saving drug. So in this study, we look at trends in out-of-pocket costs of naloxone and how they vary by payer, specifically like type of insurer, as well as how they vary by the drug brand.
So what did you find?
So we found that there's actually a large amount of variation over time and by payer and by drug brand in the out-of-pocket costs from naloxone. There's actually been dramatic improvements in access to naloxone, or the number of claims per capita that have been observed for naloxone since 2015. And that coincides with a lot of naloxone access laws that have been passed by many states. Many states have passed laws like direct dispensing and Good Samaritan laws that allow limit legal liabilities or enable pharmacists to directly dispense naloxone to those in need. But there hasn't been as much focus on the costs. So access has not consequently been, or the improvements in access that have been sort of generally experienced between 2015 and 2018 have not been experienced universally. So by 2018, those with insurance were able to, or accessed and had claims for naloxone at a rate 5.2 times higher than those without insurance. And we show that it's likely that this disparity in access is related to out-of-pocket costs. Because in 2014, before a lot of the passage of these naloxone access laws, uninsured patients paid only about $7 more. But, I mean, I say only, I think that's an important difference in and of itself. But it's they paid $7 more for naloxone than insured patients. But between 2015 and 2018, the out-of-pocket costs of naloxone for the insured actually decreased, while the out-of-pocket costs for the uninsured actually increased by 506%, from $35 per dose to approximately $250 on average. So what's more is that patients have limited or no control over the brand of drug that's offered to them by pharmacies. But the brand of drug actually plays a big role in the out-of-pocket costs that they have to pay. So if a patient showed up at a pharmacy in need of naloxone, but the pharmacy only had the brand Ebzio, which has throughout the period experienced dramatic spikes in its out-of-pocket costs, they may have ended up paying between 14.8 and 16 times as much for that dose of naloxone than if a pharmacy had offered Narcan or generic naloxone.
What are the numbers in terms of the uninsured population? Uninsured people are really getting the short end of the stick here. The sharp pointy end of the stick, actually, it sounds like. It sounds horrible.
Yeah. It's pretty dramatic. I mean, you would, I think, naturally expect for the uninsured to pay more. I mean, that's sort of the point of insurance, right? But the level of disparity between the out-of-pocket costs was surprising to me. And as you say, a lot of that's related to things that have been publicized in the past with the spikes in the cost of naloxone. A lot of that is, as we show in the paper, due to Ebzio, which has now been discontinued. But there still is a disparity, dramatic disparity, even if you're not considering Ebzio, there still is a disparity in the cost, out-of-pocket costs of naloxone for the insured versus the uninsured. And, you know, I think it's something that's been understudied, underassessed. And so, you know, a lot of the efforts to improve access to naloxone have focused outside of costs. So it stands to reason that ways to continue to improve access to naloxone may involve regulations or subsidies, things of that nature to improve the out-of-pocket or reduced out-of-pocket costs that the people pay when accessing naloxone, particularly for the uninsured, who represent a critical and vulnerable population with respect to this particular issue, because the numbers are disproportionate. 20% of the uninsured population, 20% of adults with an opioid use disorder are also uninsured, and about 30% of adults that end up dying as a result of opioid overdoses are uninsured.
Well, now, just for clarity, the estimated number of people with opioid use disorder, that number, where's it, that number comes from, is that from NISTA? Where is that?
I've got it cited in here somewhere in my paper. I don't remember each and every one of my citations, but I think that the CDC uses a variety of different sources to estimate that. There are sort of state inpatient databases that include diagnostic data for most states in the United States and can generate that estimate, as well as potentially other databases. But that would be my guess. Mm.
I ask only because, well, I have always held that the NISTA estimates are basically the low end. Especially when it comes to, they're asking about stigmatized activity, and, you know, it's a thing people don't necessarily like to admit to. And even if it is, it's the government and they're only there to help, can be a little scary. Like I say, I'm just saying, the size of the population, I'm concerned that it's actually I would think that's even a larger population of people who were affected. Well, and especially, I mean, you're just looking at people who, you know, who might have opioid use disorder, as opposed to people just, you know, who don't necessarily have what would be diagnosed as an opioid use disorder, but are using opiates. I mean, that's a huge number of people. That's a lot of people.
I mean, we are have been and continue to be experiencing an opioid crisis within our country, and the NISDA data is a survey, and so that would describe self-reported opioid use. The state inpatient database, the set of state inpatient databases would describe diagnosed opioid use disorders. So, you know, there's sort of a potential range in the rates that each of those data might report based on, as you say, a natural inclination of individuals to not want to report on risky types of behaviors like opioid use.
But the bottom line is that's a lot of people paying a lot too much.
Absolutely. I mean, we actually, just this last year, the most recent mortality data that's held by the CDC came out and showed that, you know, in spite of a lot of other things going on, pandemic and otherwise, relating to sort of a lot of excess and increased number of deaths within our country, the opioid-related mortalities actually peaked last year. And that's not necessarily, I guess, all that surprising, given that the pandemic can exacerbate, you know, sort of a lot of the restrictions and social isolation and the resulting economic upheaval that happened during the pandemic can be related to, you know, a lot of the behaviors that can exacerbate or initiate opioid use and lead to some of these really tragic outcomes.
This is an interview with Evan Peet, PhD. He's an economist at the Rand Corporation, a professor at Pardee Rand Graduate School, and he's one of the co-authors of an article published August 19th by the JAMA Health Forum entitled Trends in Out-of-Pocket Costs for Naloxone by Drug Brand and Payer in the U.S. 2010 to 2018. We'll have more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. As I mentioned at the top of the show, International Overdose Awareness Day is August 31st. An unregulated supply of some drugs means that when people use a currently banned substance, they may end up taking something they didn't intend to use. Fentanyl and fentanyl analogs are the most widely known contaminants these days, but they're not the only ones. As we see the pendulum swing back towards more stimulant use, we will see more different novel psychoactive substances make their way into the unregulated supply. And we'll see more death. Supervised consumption sites, also known as overdose prevention centers, could help if we allow them to set up, if they're allowed to perform drug checking services on site, and if they have the funding for testing devices. I mean, heck, if they've got the funding and the necessary equipment, maybe they don't wait for permission from the authorities. Maybe instead, in order to save lives, they risk arrest. They put their bodies on the line. And maybe if there's funding for health services, then maybe people can also get referrals for the medical care they need when they visit. Of course, if health services aren't available because there's no funding for them, and there's really nowhere to refer people, is there? I mean, it's the same for treatment. If people are really ready to start treatment, then people going to a supervised consumption site, an overdose prevention center, oh, they can get referred to treatment. They can get started right away, but they can only do that if there are actually slots available in a methadone program or if there are physicians available who are willing to prescribe buprenorphine for patients who may not have insurance. And that, by the way, is another difference between a safe consumption site and a bar. No bartender is expected to refer their regulars to Alcoholics Anonymous or some other treatment. Regular heavy alcohol users are how bars make big money. You know, but I digress. The point is, there is a lot that could be done if we just make the resources available, if we set up these centers, if we fund healthcare, if we fund treatment. You know, that, by the way, that's the beauty of Oregon's Measure 110. Not only did it decriminalize simple possession of some currently banned substances, Measure 110 is also putting millions of dollars into essential services that are vitally needed. If we want people to live less chaotic lives, if we want people to get into recovery, well, they need to be alive to do that. And they need faith. They need to trust the system. And that trust has to be earned. It takes time. And, you know, and again, they need to be alive for that. Of course, with legally regulated drugs, we don't get these problems because, well, they're legally regulated. You don't get people adding a little something-something to your wine or beer or whiskey to give it a fatal extra kick. The equipment used for bottling that legal liquid drug, that's not contaminated. They actually clean it. Legal regulation means a better, safer, more reliable product. We've been trying to force people to comply with prohibition of some drugs for more than a century now, without success. In the process, we've allowed criminal organizations to grow richer and more powerful. We've allowed our police and civic institutions to grow more and more corrupt. And we've allowed thousands of our friends and our neighbors and our family members to die. And it's time we tried something that works for a change. In today's interview with Dr. Pete, we talk a lot about how people are discouraged from getting naloxone because of the cost. That is one of the barriers. I mean, first, there's simple awareness. People need to learn about what naloxone can do. And then there's access. I mean, is it available without prescription? Is it only available through a physician or to first responders? And then there's the cost, because access to something that's too expensive, well, that's not really access, especially when those costs are artificially inflated. I mean, that's price gouging. When we look at how many people are discouraged from getting and carrying naloxone, we have to look at more than the estimated 2.1 million people that the National Survey on Drug Use and Health in 2017 determined had opioid use disorder. That, by the way, is from the footnotes and going further into the footnotes. That estimate from NISTA is based on the number of people who are willing to admit to the NICE Fed that they use opioids. And then those respondents get asked more questions about their use, and if they respond in a certain way, then they meet the criteria of this screen. The point is, the estimated number of people that NISTA thinks meet that criteria for opioid use disorder, that's very likely an undercount. Now, leaving aside any kind of questions about their definition of opioid use disorder and all that, beyond that's the fact that not everyone who's getting their opioids from the unregulated market has an opioid use disorder, even by NISTA's definition. But if they're using the unregulated market, then they are at risk of exposure to fentanyl and a possible overdose. There are a lot of people who really should carry naloxone, a lot. There are harm reduction organizations around the country that distribute naloxone to people who need it. They do it free of charge. They've saved countless lives. And the lives at stake, I mean, that could be your child, could be your sibling, your partner, your best friend. There's probably a harm reduction organization or harm reduction advocates in your local area working to try and save lives. Find them. Find them and give them your support. The next life they save could be someone that you could not bear to lose.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's hear the rest of that interview with Evan Pete, PhD. We're recording this, earlier today, the CDC released new provisional data looking at overdose. They're now at the 12-month period that ended March 31st, 2022. They predict that the final number will be 109,247 people for that 12-month period. That's all overdose, toxins in the supply of banned drugs and simple overdose. But huge numbers of people. And a thing like naloxone, which in the case of opioid use, in the case of an opioid overdose, could save their lives.
Yeah, naloxone is an absolutely critical tool we have in combating this opioid crisis going on. And as you say, there's a lot of different ways in which overdoses look. The opioid crisis has evolved from one that may have started out with the misuse or abuse of prescription opioids to later involving heroin or fentanyl, big issue right now, or even polysubstance abuse at the moment. But naloxone is one of those tools that saves lives. And efforts to expand access to naloxone are absolutely critical. You can't stop opioid misuse and abuse in a person if that person is no longer living. So the problem is ongoing and it's huge. And it's something that we are investing as a country a lot of money, both in research as well as in policies and other endeavors to try to fight. And so I think one of the takeaways of our research is that we need to be fully utilizing all of the tools in our arsenal.
Well, that's a good segue. What are some of the policy implications from your research?
Right. So, you know, evidence suggests that lots of improvements can be made to increase the low rates of prescribing of naloxone. That includes co-prescribing of naloxone to individuals that have been that have opioid use disorders or that may be at risk of opioid misuse and abuse. I know a lot of states are talking about new laws or new initiatives to facilitate co-prescribing that would just enable the naloxone to be there in case of any emergencies, right? As opposed to the emergency happening and then having to go get the naloxone where there may be some limited access, right? So, a lot of these policies that have been in place or that are being talked about and may be put into place in the future, the effects of them may be muted if the patients aren't able to afford the drugs, right? And so I think in some of the policy recommendations that we would have from this paper is to say, as we're considering these additional ways to increase access to and specifically ready access to naloxone in case of emergencies, that cost should also be considered in that discussion. And so, you know, ways for that to be addressed may be require pharmacies to maintain a stock of particularly generic naloxone, lower out-of-pocket cost on naloxone, so it's available to particularly to uninsured patients. There could be a direct funding set up to cover the out-of-pocket cost of naloxone that is distributed to pharmacies and uninsured patients. There's also the Ryan White HIV model program, which includes co-pay support for uninsured patients. And there's also something that's been talked about a lot in the news recently with the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act that includes the ability of Medicare to negotiate prices, that there could be additional regulations or greater governmental involvement in the negotiation of pharmaceutical prices.
So, well, what can people do?
People can be looking after their neighbors. A lot of states, I don't know if that's off the top of my head if Oregon has or not, but a lot of states have passed Good Samaritan laws. I believe Oregon has. I'm not an Oregon resident, so I'm not sure. But that means that, sort of legal liabilities associated with providing naloxone to people who are judged to be in need are limited or non-existent. And so I think whatever stigmas may be associated with carrying naloxone it's sad that those may exist because someone who has family members who struggle with addiction, it's a disease, and so it's something that we need to be a lot better about handling and more compassionate. And I think a lot of in one way that may involve people who, you know, don't have an opioid use disorder, but who love people who do. It may involve them carrying naloxone with them in case of emergencies. And you know, beyond that, I think that there's a lot of scope for people to interact with their representatives and to let them know that, you know, the efforts that have been made to improve access to naloxone are appreciated, and but that there are still efforts, there's still work to be done. And one of the ways in which we can do that work is to, you know, try to focus our efforts on reducing the price barrier that many, particularly uninsured patients face in accessing naloxone.
What question have I not asked you yet that I should have?
Like I said at the beginning, this was a sort of a small part of a broader, this study was a small part of a broader effort to study naloxone access and the impacts of naloxone on opioid-related overdose mortalities. And so, you know, another part of the way that we're looking into this is through the impacts of pharmaceutical innovations. Narcan was actually a pharmaceutical innovation because it previous iterations of naloxone had to be administered by trained professionals, whereas Narcan is a nasal injector, and so it can be administered by lay people. And so some of our other research, which isn't published yet, but we're working on getting published soon, it shows I think the pharmaceutical companies can get vilified a little bit, but they are a source of innovation, and that innovation in this case was beneficial. That Narcan sort of made naloxone more available to a broader set of people to administer, in and of itself save lives. In addition, if it were also accompanied, and this is part of the nuance, is that innovation was sort of catalyzed by the presence of naloxone access laws in place prior to the innovation. So for states that had already expanded their naloxone access laws with direct dispensing and other laws, that the introduction of Narcan resulted in a much larger reduction in overdose-related mortalities than in other states that did not have those laws in place.
Policies can drive innovation.
Absolutely.
That was my interview with Evan Peet, PhD, an economist at the RAND Corporation, also a professor at Pardee RAND Graduate School, and one of the co-authors of an article published August 19th in the JAMA Health Forum entitled Trends in Out-of-Pocket Costs for Naloxone by Drug Brand and Payer in the U.S. 2010 to 2018. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.